Today is Monday, September 14th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko is in Russia amid massive protests against his rule.
We've seen a wave of demonstrations against Lukashenko's calling for his resignation ever since a contested August 9th presidential election.
Also ahead, Japan is set to have a new prime minister. Plus, the World Health Organization calls on rich countries to join its COVID-19 vaccine distribution program. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Russia. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko is in Sochi, Russia today to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Lukashenko faces massive demonstrations against his 26-year rule following a disputed election. On Sunday, an estimated 100,000 people took to the streets of the Belarusian capital Minsk to oppose the longtime president. Meanwhile, Putin's United Russia Party scored an overwhelming victory in local elections Sunday, though opposition candidates made gains in Siberia. For more, I spoke to journalist Charles Maines in Moscow.
Belarusian longtime president Alexander Lukashenko arrived to Sochi. He'll be meeting with President Vladimir Putin of Russia on Monday. The two sides will meet alone with no delegations. This is as Lukashenko comes to Putin, really seeking Russian backing amid a popular uprising against his 26-year rule. We've seen a wave of demonstrations against Lukashenko's calling for his resignation ever since a contested August 9th presidential election that Lukashenko insists he won in a landslide. We saw another huge protest on Sunday, a slightly smaller one the day before. But on Sunday, over 100,000 demonstrators marched in the capital, Minsk, and of course, demonstrators in other cities of Belarus. This is for the fourth straight weekend in a row. So ever since this election, people have been coming out insisting this was a rigged election to keep Lukashenko in power. And you saw Lukashenko's security forces try and keep these protests under control. They were trying to pick off protesters as they were making their way towards the city center, and they just got swamped. And when there were reports of over 700 arrests, but in the face of 100,000 plus protesters, it didn't seem to make much of a difference. And the general assumption, sort of conventional wisdom has it, that Lukashenko is diminished by this as he goes into these talks with Putin. Putin also has to weigh, you know, whether he wants to keep supporting Lukashenko or whether, you know, there are risks here that he could also lose the support of the Belarusian people.
The UN Human Rights Council in Geneva has agreed today to take a look at the situation in Belarus. Can you tell us about that?
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is looking into these cases of police violence. We saw this police crackdown in the wake of the vote. We've had over 7,000 arrests, again, 700 just on Sunday. And more worrisome than even just the arrests themselves is this really, really grim portrait that people who come out of the prisons present of being beaten by police, of being tortured by police. So there are real concerns there. You know, at this point, Vladimir Putin has given essentially lukewarm support for the security forces in Belarus, saying that they've conducted themselves with some restraint. I think most people would probably find that hard to believe, given some of the evidence that's come out. Mr. Lukashenko, he says that the protesters have been painting these bruises on their bodies, that none of this was real. Lukashenko comes arguing that these protests are part of, you know, essentially a Western plot to, one, dethrone him and also expand NATO to Russia's borders and possibly beyond. And this is a pretty naked attempt to try and draw Russia into this, essentially what should be a domestic debate within Belarus, that he lost an election in the eyes of these of the opposition. And so what he's trying to do at this point is see if he can sort of get Russia involved in this bigger east-west standoff. It's an open question how successful he'll be, although it's important also to point out that Vladimir Putin is no fan of street revolutions. He's no fan of overturning the powers that be through the ballot box. He's also been in power for 20-some years. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics at play here in Sochi, and we'll have to see how they shake out.
Now, there's also politics happening in Russia. In particular, there were local elections which took place Sunday. What's happened there?
was a three-day election cycle this time because of concerns of the coronavirus, although observers would say that that also opened the door to a lot of violations, whether it's ballot stuffing or early voting that seemed unrealistically high. Candidates tied to the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, who was stricken by poisoning, is now recovering in a German hospital. They won some key races in Siberia. That was an interesting dynamic. But the overall message seemed to be this kind of overwhelming victory for pro-Kremlin candidates in the governorships and the powerful governorships, which would seem to point, kind of seem in the face of, fly in the face of logic in the sense that, you know, we've seen falling polling numbers. We've seen the government struggle, a lot of unhappiness over the economy. And what was interesting here is to see the governors in six cases in particular scoring ratings victories that matched Lukashenko's in Belarus. They got over 80% of the vote.
That was journalist Charles Maines in Moscow. In Japan, Yoshihide Suga, a longtime ally of retiring Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, won a ruling Liberal Democratic Party leadership election on Monday, paving the way for him to become prime minister in a parliamentary vote this week. Reuters' Emmer McCarthy reports.
Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga won a landslide victory in a ruling party leadership election on Monday, paving the way for him to replace Shinzo Abe as prime minister later this week. 71-year-old Suga has said he would continue Abe's signature Abenomics strategy of hyper-easy monetary policy, government spending and reforms, while juggling the problems of COVID-19 and a slumping economy, while confronting longer-term issues such as Japan's aging population and low birth rate.
We must overcome this crisis so that each person in Japan can feel safe and have a stable life. In order to do that, we need to carry on Prime Minister Abe's measures and move forward with them. I believe it is my mission to do so.
Suga won 377 votes out of 534 votes cast and 535 possible votes in the Liberal Democratic Party election by the party's members of parliament and representatives of its 47 local chapters. It is virtually certain that he'll be elected prime minister in a parliamentary vote on Wednesday because of the LDP's majority in the lower house. He will serve out Abe's term as party leader through to September 2021. The son of a strawberry farmer from northern Japan, Suga was a loyal aide to outgoing Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who announced his resignation last month due to ill health.
That was Emmer McCarthy of Reuters. This is VOA. At least 35 people have died in massive forest fires racing across the western U.S. states of California, Oregon, and Washington, the AP reports. Tens of thousands have had to flee their homes to escape flames that have destroyed entire neighborhoods. The major cities of Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland, Oregon, are now engulfed in smoke with some of the worst air quality in the world. There are warnings of low moisture and strong winds through Monday evening, which could worsen the situation. On the other side of the U.S., residents of the storm-battered Gulf Coast are preparing for another hurricane. The U.S. National Hurricane Center in Miami says Tropical Storm Sally is expected to become a hurricane Monday and reach shore late in the day. The Associated Press says the center warns of flooding and other dangerous weather conditions to the states of Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. The same region was hit by Hurricane Laura last month, and Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards says many people who had fled Hurricane Laura to the city of New Orleans are now in the path of Hurricane Sally. The U.S. Open tennis tournament wrapped up Sunday in New York. It was the first major tennis tournament and one of the first finals of any sport to take place since the COVID-19 pandemic shut down athletic competitions around the world. 27-year-old Dominic Thiem of Austria won the men's singles final over German Alexander Zverev. It was his first major title. In the women's final, Japanese 22-year-old Naomi Osaka defeated Victoria Azarenka of Belarus. This is Osaka's third major title and second U.S. Open win. Osaka, whose father is from Haiti, used the tournament to support the Black Lives Matter movement. She entered each match wearing a face mask with the names of Black Americans killed in recent years. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called on wealthy countries to join the COVAX vaccine facility. The COVAX program is meant to ensure that any future vaccine against COVID-19 is fairly and efficiently distributed across the world. So far, 92 lower-income nations are seeking assistance via the COVAX facility, part of the WHO's ACT Accelerator to boost development of vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics to combat the pandemic. Some 80 higher-income nations have expressed interest, but many must still confirm their intention to join by the end of this week. Here's WHO Director Tedros.
In our interconnected world, if people in low and middle income countries miss out on vaccines, the virus will continue to kill and the economic recovery globally will be delayed. I thank the many member states who have expressed interest in joining the COVAX facility. And I urge those of you who have not yet joined to do so by this Friday.
Numerous wealthier Western nations have not joined the COVAX facility, despite some of those nations having major COVID-19 outbreaks.
Many of your countries have been among the hardest hit. We're by no means out of the woods. The average daily numbers of cases in the region is now higher than it was during the first peak in March. Fortunately, the number of deaths appears to be remaining at a relatively low level for now. If we do not keep transmission in check, more people will lose their lives. And there is the real risk of reintroducing so-called lockdown measures that have been so costly.
The WHO reports nearly 29 million total COVID-19 cases worldwide and over 921,000 deaths. About 5.6 million Italian students went back to school today as Italy's schools fully reopened 6 months after being closed to fight the spread of the novel coronavirus. The students joined about 2.5 million who went back earlier this month. Students are finding new rules for temperature checks, wearing masks, and physical distancing. Italy was hard hit by the virus early in the pandemic, particularly in the country's rural and mountainous north. It has confirmed nearly 290,000 cases, the World Health Organization says, with about 36,000 deaths. But after months of restrictions, the country is reporting about 1,400 cases a day, a quarter of its peak caseload. Also in Italy, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi left the hospital on Monday, 11 days after testing positive for the virus. The 83-year-old former leader described the illness as the most difficult challenge of his life. Some of Australia's toughest coronavirus restrictions imposed in Melbourne have been relaxed as recorded daily cases continue to fall. The Victorian state government has said there will be a staged easing of lockdown measures in the coming months if infection rates decline. Australia has had about 26,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and more than 800 people have died. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Melbourne has been in lockdown since early July, but as daily coronavirus cases fall, some measures are being relaxed. A nighttime curfew is starting an hour later, playgrounds are reopening, and more outdoor exercise is permitted under the first of a four-step recovery plan. But strict stay-at-home orders remain in place in Australia's second most populous city. Schools and childcare centres are closed, while cafes and restaurants can offer only takeaways. Shops might not be allowed to reopen until the end of November. The gradual reopening of businesses and the return of personal freedoms will depend on how quickly rates of infection decline. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews says the lockdown measures are working, but he acknowledges that life is hard for a community where freedoms are restricted.
It's challenging out there, I know it's difficult, but the strategy is working. And that's something that is altogether the product of enormous sacrifice and hard work that each and every Victorian who's following the rules, playing their part, that work is what's driving these numbers down. I'm absolutely grateful to every single Victorian who's doing that important work and staying the course so that we properly defeat this second wave.
Critics say the measures are too harsh and are wrecking the economy. Nationally, the pandemic has sent Australia into recession for the first time in three decades. The Victorian government has extended a state of disaster for another month, giving the police extra powers to enforce public health orders. 74 people were arrested Sunday during illegal anti-lockdown protests in Melbourne. On Monday, Victoria recorded 35 new cases of coronavirus in the past 24 hours, and seven more people have died. The southern state is at the heart of Australia's COVID-19 crisis, accounting for 75% of cases and 9 in 10 fatalities. A judicial inquiry is investigating claims that security failures in the hotel quarantine system for travellers returning from overseas allowed the virus to spread into the community, causing a devastating second wave of infections. Melbourne's lockdown will continue until at least September 28, but disease control measures in the rest of Victoria state will likely be eased this week because of low rates of infection. The city will move to step two of its recovery plan if the average number of daily cases over a two-week period is between 30 and 50. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In the U.S., COVID-19 cases top 6.5 million, with deaths nearing 200,000. The U.S. has averaged over 34,000 new cases and more than 700 deaths per day over the past week. Even so, U.S. President Donald Trump held an indoor campaign rally in the state of Nevada Sunday. It was his first indoor rally since June. That event in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was blamed for a surge in coronavirus infections, the AP reports. For more on Trump's Sunday rally in Nevada, here's AP's Julie Walker.
In open defiance of his own administration's pandemic health guidelines and state regulations, President Trump hosted his first indoor rally since June, this one Sunday night in Nevada. In the warehouse near Las Vegas, with most people not wearing masks and no social distancing, Trump said, "We're defeating the coronavirus.
We're making that round, beautiful last turn."
The virus is still claiming 1,000 lives a day in the U.S. In Nevada, gatherings are limited to 50 people, and Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak criticized Trump, who went on the attack.
"You have a governor right now who's a political hack."
He also unloaded on challenger Joe Biden.
"He is the worst candidate in the history of presidential politics."
Biden's campaign said in a statement, "Every rally-turned-super-spreader event Trump decides to hold serves as another reminder he refuses to take the pandemic seriously." I'm Julie Walker.
The number of Indo-Pacific humpback dolphins seen around Hong Kong has jumped as the pause in high-speed ferry traffic due to the coronavirus allows the threatened species to make something of a comeback, scientists said. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Hong Kong's waters are usually a busy marine highway with the hum of boats carrying passengers between Hong Kong and China and the gambling hub Macau in high-speed ferries. But the travel restrictions have emptied some of the areas of bigger boats. Making the most of the quiet are the Indo-Pacific humpback dolphins.
So tantalizing.
They'll come back.
Known as the Chinese white dolphins, their comeback has given scientists a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to study the impact of underwater noise on the aquatic mammals.
Oh, one right at our 12, very close. You might want to go into neutral.
Marine scientist Lindsay Porter of the University of St Andrews has studied the dolphins for three decades.
Since the ferries have stopped in this area, as dolphins that we hadn't seen for 4, 5, 6 years are back in the Hong Kong habitat.
Porter and her team rely on photography and underwater recordings for their research, tracking and logging the dolphins' behaviour. But how do they tell them apart?
Now, people think, well, how can you possibly recognise one dolphin from another? all we do is take images of their dorsal fins, and believe it or not, the shape, the markings, the coloration of the dolphin is so varied between individuals that it's quite easy for us to tell the difference.
Dolphin sightings now appear to be up as much as 30%, which Porter says is remarkable to see how rapidly the dolphins appear to have adapted to the changes in their environment. But there's pause among the excitement, as the increase in numbers is likely to reflect new migratory patterns for now, rather than a growing population. Pinning down the exact number of the population is also a tricky task. Hong Kong World Wildlife Fund estimates the dolphin population in the Pearl River estuary to be around 2,000, whereas a survey by the University of Hong Kong put the number at around 400 in 2017. But the Hong Kong government said the latest figures show only 52 dolphins in 2019. The WWF attributes the discrepancy to different research methodologies. The city's government has taken an active interest in improving its conservation policies in recent years and operates 6 marine parks, which have certain restrictions on marine traffic. But conservationists have criticized these measures as insufficient, arguing that the dolphins remain at risk of colliding with high-speed ferries. Porter has cautioned that despite recent improvements, Hong Kong's dolphin population may never return to sustainable levels.
I feel sometimes that we're simply documenting the demise of this population of dolphins, but I feel it's really important that we do understand what the impact is of man and his activities on this population. So perhaps we can use this knowledge elsewhere to save other or protect better other dolphin populations.
Thanks to Libby Hogan of Reuters for that report. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and the entire International Edition team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Tune in tomorrow morning when Steve Miller will be hosting. That show will broadcast and rebroadcast at 3:30, 4:30, 5:30, and 6:30 a.m. in Dakar, 4:30, 5:30, 6:30, and 7:30 in Kinshasa, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30 in Johannesburg, and 7:30, 8:30, 9:30, and 10:30 a.m. in Nairobi. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Independent Cuban journalist Roberto de Jesus Quiñones has at last been reunited with his family after a year of undue suffering as a prisoner of conscience in Cuba. While relieved at his release, the United States repeats its strong condemnation of his unjust imprisonment for the simple act of doing his job, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. On August 7, 2019, the Cuban regime convicted Quiñones on dubious charges of resistance and disobedience and sentenced him to 1 year in a labor camp. His detention and trial were marked by flagrant disregard for legal norms. Cuban authorities did not inform Quiñones of the charges against him until minutes before the trial and did not permit him legal representation in the courtroom. The regime's prosecutors prevented Quiñones from presenting evidence of his injuries at the hands of the police who arrested him. In March, he was denied parole. It is disgraceful that the Cuban regime incarcerated a journalist whose only crime is working for a more transparent society, said Secretary Pompeo. It is also unsurprising. The regime uses any excuse to silence its critics and to violate human rights, including the rights to freedom of expression and to fair trial guarantees. Cuba remains the most restricted climate for the press in the Americas, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. The same organization ranks Cuba among the top 10 most censored countries. Print and broadcast media are wholly controlled by the Cuban Communist government and by law must be in accordance with the goals of the socialist society. The United States calls on its democratic partners across the globe to make respect for human rights, including freedom of the press, a prerequisite for any dealings with Cuba.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.